So if that is all, I will have the marshal announce the court.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Johnson, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Judge Carol A. Hooten presiding.
All right, Dad. The matter before us this morning is the case of Jennifer Schroeder et al. Versus the Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. The file number is A201264. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. I would ask that if you are not arguing that you please keep the mute button on your computer. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments and let us know who you are representing in this matter. With that being said, I do want to welcome you here in our virtual hearing today, and the appellant at this time may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Craig Coleman on behalf of plaintiffs, appellants. The plaintiffs and my co-counsel are participating in this hearing by remote access. The lack of any justification for Minnesota's system of felony disenfranchisement, which is reflected by the record in this case, is shocking. For no good reason, 53,000 Minnesotans are barred from voting while they live in the community. Appellants bring Mr. constitutional Coleman, can claims I, under three provisions Mr. of the Minnesota Mr. Coleman, Constitution.
Mr. Yes, Mr. Coleman, can you? I'm sorry, thank you. I just wanted to, because it's a high level question I have, and you've kind of perhaps hit on it. I see from all of the briefs and all of the amici, the phrase disenfranchisement, that's probably the word that's been used most, and you just used it here a moment ago. My question is kind of a square peg round hole sort of a scenario when applying our traditional jurisprudence of equal protection to this case. And the reason I'm asking is it seems that the source of the disenfranchisement is our state's constitution. And so not the legislature, and that's typically what we see. In fact, all the cases that both parties have cited and that I have found are judicial review of legislatively began and ended, arguably created rules or statutes or ordinances. But here, we have a constitutional provision that disenfranchises those with felony convictions and then creates until civil rights are restored. So we start with the disenfranchisements in our state's constitution. And then we have a conscious, because we will read this consciously, decision not to define the when civil rights are determined, which therefore means necessarily our founders of our state delegated that under our three equal branches of government to the one body that would make that determination, the legislative. And of course, we've seen from all the briefing and the amici, the history in our state. So you can see my struggle at what am I missing? What law, what case, or perhaps even a learned treaty that would suggest to me that our normal jurisprudence of equal protection, and so this is regard before we get to strict scrutiny versus any level of scrutiny, would apply here when the disenfranchisement's identified by the Constitution and there's a purposeful decision not to make a decision of when civil rights are restored. I'm having a hard time, and so I'm hoping you could maybe help me. And I realize this goes back to all of our con law days, perhaps, but that seems like this is exactly what's before our court right now.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor, for directing me to your concern in approaching this. At bottom, I think we have a disagreement with how you have read Article 7, or at least what's underlying your question. So, and I think we should start in approaching Article 7. We can't just gloss over this court's and the state's long case law recognizing the fundamental principle that voting rights are an essential fundamental right. They're at the core of our constitutional concern, and courts have a critical role in protecting constitutional rights. So we urge the court to bring that case law to bear here. And as soon as judicial scrutiny has to play a role, as soon as an Article 7 exception is expanded beyond its narrowest terms. But let's start with Article 7. Article 7, by its terms, restores voting rights to persons upon their release into the community. Every version of constitutional interpretation leads to that result. If we start with evidence of original intent, there is simply no basis to conclude that the framers intended to disenfranchise persons living in the community.
Well, could I stop you there? Because I mean, you are basically asking for an overhaul of all of our criminal statutes and our case law, because we have a whole series of case law that says that a person on probation has a significantly diminished expectation of privacy as compared to someone who is not on probation. And in fact, there's a whole pattern of case law that says that probationers do not enjoy the absolute liberty that every other citizen enjoys. So to the extent, so there's a recognition under our criminal system that the period of probation or a period of parole, that those people are in a different situation than an ordinary citizen who's never been convicted, as in this case, of a felony. Isn't that true?
I want to put aside the question of privacy. Judge Sleater's question was asked, how should we interpret Article 7?
I know, but you're basically saying that all these probationers and people on parole should get all the rights that everyone else has. But
that is not our position, Your Honor. Well, our position, appellants have been denied the right to vote. They come to this court asking to restore the right to vote. The question is whether Article 7 prohibits that. And in terms of original intent, in terms of the text of the Constitution, in terms of the structure and the meaning of the Constitution, this court should interpret Article 7 to be consistent with voting while people live in the community. Upon release from incarceration, individuals have all rights and responsibilities relevant to voting. They can consume news, they can participate in political campaigns, as some of the appellants do. They can attend their polling place. So whatever restrictions might be inherent in our system of community supervision, which has been layered over the top of our criminal justice system since its founding, we don't think those have any relevance to whether appellants possess the relevant civil rights relevant to voting and the right to vote.
Well, isn't the issue here that you're contesting is the timing of the restoration of rights? And you've narrowed it to just the right to vote. Isn't that the only issue that's before us? And whether our state's legislative decision to restore those upon discharge from probation is constitutional. Isn't that the only issue that's really before us?
Well, I would reject the notion that that's the only issue. And I think the Russell thing, the court needs to struggle and work through Russell. But I do think your question takes us in a helpful direction, because the legislature has made a decision about the timing of when to restore civil rights, and in particular, the right to vote. Both sides agree here. The secretary has conceded that the legislature, at a minimum, has discretion to restore appellants' voting rights. So the legislature has made a decision, and our clients are disenfranchised by that exercise of legislative discretion, not the terms of Article 7. And so that is where judicial scrutiny has to play a role. The legislature has made a choice. It has chosen to defer or deny voting rights between incarceration and discharge of sentence.
A policy decision, though? I mean, because I can tell you, as a district court judge, I had, and I'm sure than any district court judge will tell you, we have full calendars of people who are on probation, are have violated their conditions of parole that are before us, and we're ending up sending them back to prison. And so the legislature basically has made a policy decision that rather than get into the complexities of dealing with that situation, first you can vote one day and then you can't vote the next day. We are just going to determine that the restoration of rights takes place when there's a discharge from probation, our completion of the period of when the person is on parole. Why would that not be a rational way to deal with when those rights are restored? Because then you have some certainty, and the court actually loses jurisdiction over the person. And there's a clear delineation between the time they're on probation with the loss of many of their civil rights and the time they're completely restored to all of those rights.
Well, a couple things, Your Honor. For starters, the legislature has never articulated a reason or purpose or even a deliberate policy decision to disenfranchise persons living in the community. It simply never considered the question. And so in adopting 609.165, the legislature stated its interest in ensuring restoration of voting rights, discharge of sentence, to further rehabilitation, to eliminate the stigma associated with disenfranchisement. That legislative interest is undermined. It's actively at cross purposes with disenfranchisement of persons on probation. And so, Your Honor, as you're aware, upon release from incarceration, we want persons on probation actively participating in civil society. We want them working, parenting, doing all of those things, being active members of society. Why are we denying them the right to vote? What's the purpose of that? The legislature has simply never articulated it. And the court cannot gloss over Russell and heightened rational basis review, where we've disproportionately disenfranchised persons of color. There's no dispute about the disproportionate impact and the profound constitutional concerns that that raises. We have to have a legislative purpose in this.
Well, can I want to ask you about that too. I mean, there were a lot of statistics that you presented, which did indicate that there is a disproportionate impact on persons of color. However, I noted that those statistics did not take into account a lot of the reforms that have taken place within the last year or so regarding, number one, that there's a cap on how much probation a judge can give anyone now. It's capped at 5 years unless there's some circumstances that the judge can justify going longer than that. And also we've had a total reform of our drug cases. And I don't know that any of your statistics dealt with any change that those big changes in the criminal law and the criminal justice system might have on those statistics. Am I correct on that?
The secretary has never argued that this law doesn't have a disparate impact. And so I think the record perhaps is undeveloped on some of those statistics, but that is not a basis to gloss over the relief that these plaintiffs are coming to court to remedy. So moreover, I would say Professor Ugin's report walks through all of the systemic racial disparities, well, not all of them, but many of them throughout the criminal justice system, from arrest to conviction. So I really strongly do not think there's a basis to believe that our recent reforms, however justified those might be, have provided a remedy or eliminated racial disparities in our criminal justice system. We have counties in Minnesota where 10% of Black residents who should be eligible to vote are disenfranchised. 12% of American Indian residents in some counties are disenfranchised. That's a five-alarm fire constitutionally. And we do not think the court should look past that. And in fact, the logic of Russell is that when the court is faced with a systemic racial disparity caused by a statute, here with respect to the right to vote, The court just needs to ask whether there's a reason for it. Why do we do this? Why do we disenfranchise persons? What's the basis for it? And the legislature has never articulated a reason.
Go ahead and respond to the question.
Just in terms of Judge Hooten asked the question about the administrability of the terms and probation and managing the system. We think administration of the system and the bright line rule that we are proposing is the easiest mechanism. If people are incarceration, our relief does not ask that we restore their voting rights. If people can attend their polling place and have the freedom to show up and vote, they should be allowed to do that. That is the easiest system to administer, and it actually eliminates quite a bit of uncertainty underlying the current system. Please, Your Honor.
My question had to do with your request for relief and to be specific about it. I think ordinarily when there's a constitutional challenge to a statute, if it's determined to be unconstitutional, the statute is struck down. It's, you know, effectively removed from the books and it does not operate anymore. In this situation, I mean, I think it's Article 7 that does the disenfranchising. The statute you're challenging essentially re-enfranchises people. So if we were to strike down that statute, if the statute's gone, then what? I'm unclear about what, you know, what would... It seems to me your clients would be worse off without any statute, without that statute. So then what would happen?
I see my time's up, but I want to address your question and I'll try to do it briefly. But first, started a question, but I think for all of the reasons in our brief, Article 7 should be read to restore voting rights upon release from incarceration. Whether we look at the plain language of the text, it does not delegate or create any sort of express discretion to the legislature. It doesn't involve the governor of the legislature at all in restoring rights, and instead uses passive voice, unless restored to civil rights, which simply occurs when people are released into the community and gain the right to go to the polls.
According to the statute. Well, I guess I'm not sure if you answered my question. I mean, if there is no statute, I guess maybe you have answered my question. You're saying that we should provide that kind of, I'll call it a muscular interpretation of the constitutional provisions, so then no statute is thereafter necessary? Is that what you're asking us to do?
Yeah, either that, Your Honor, or simply scrutinize. So at a minimum, both sides agree that the narrowest interpretation of Article 7 would allow the legislature to decide when to restore voting rights. And we think that the court should be involved in scrutinizing any exercise of legislative discretion that expands disenfranchisement beyond its narrowest terms. Now, specifically in terms of 609.165, there actually doesn't need to be, the statute doesn't need to be struck down or rewritten, because it actually, 609.165 by its terms does not disenfranchise persons living in the community. It simply says, sets a point in time at which they certainly are disenfranchised. So the court, you know, we believe can grant our clients relief simply by restoring their right to vote and directing the secretary not to interpret 609.165 inconsistent with our clients having the right to vote as they live in the community.
I'm a little surprised at what you just said, because I understood the entire case to be a constitutional challenge to the statute. Your complaint said so, I think, in each of the three counts that were pleaded. And I did notice in your appellate brief that you often refer to the disenfranchisement scheme rather than the particular statute. But still, I mean, isn't the nature of your argument that Section 609.165 is unconstitutional in violation of either the Equal Protection Principle or Due Process Clause?
It's really been unconstitutional in terms of its implementation. And when you read 609.165, it does not deny voting rights to persons prior to discharge of sentence. It simply says that upon discharge, they are re-enfranchised. And so our clients are in the position of being unable to vote because the Secretary of State, and I will say 209.145, additionally has sort of the mechanisms where the Department of Corrections interfaces with the Secretary of State, who interfaces with county administrators of our elections to purge our clients and others in the community from the voting polls. But 609.165, and I do think this is important because it goes to rational basis review. It does not reflect a legislative judgment to disenfranchise persons in the community. That's simply how it's been interpreted and affected. And we do think that's part of the irrationality of the scheme, is that no one has ever articulated, including the legislature, why our clients or others in the community should be denied voting rights.
Judge Hooten, could I just ask one follow-up question, please?
Okay.
Mr. Coleman, I'm still not sure I fully understand your answer to Judge Johnson's question as it relates to the statute, because it is that statute that gives a timing and a methodology of how one's civil rights are restored. And so that's why I think the interpretation Judge Johnson made is good. It's a re-enfranchisement process, and subdivision two defines that it will occur by a judge's order upon expiration of the sentence after either stay of imposition or stay of execution, hence the probation. I understand that's the point of your contention. So it would seem to me it's not, to say it another way, the Secretary of State would be obliged to follow that statute. Am I correct? And it's that statute that you would have asked, your group, at least appellants have asked in the past, as I understand, the legislature to change, and so far unsuccessfully. And you're asking us to either change it. But again, as Judge Johnson says, if it goes away, then the disenfranchisement of the Constitution remains in place and there's no method to restore one's civil rights.
We're asking the court for injunctive relief. I mean, we're coming to the courthouse. In the tradition of Doe v. Gomez, where the court says, if there is a constitutional wrong, courts need to provide a remedy. And we're asking the court to restore our clients' voting rights. Now, and I don't think we should get overly hung up on the 609.165 question, because we're asking the court to issue an order saying, allow our clients to vote. It does not make sense to disenfranchise them. The legislature has never articulated a reason to do so. But
what do we do, though, in that scenario with the language of the Constitution that disenfranchises those convicted of a felony?
Unless restored to civil rights. And we think the court should read that provision based on original intent, plain meaning of the Constitution, and the structure narrowly. But we also, again, to the extent the legislature has, and there are several questions about this, the notion that the legislature has exercised policy discretion to make a decision, to the extent it has, courts should play a role in policing that and insist when, if the exercise of that discretion results in the deprivation of voting rights, there needs to be a basis for it. It should be rational. And there isn't one here. The deprivation of our clients' voting rights is utterly at odds with any legislative purpose that's ever been stated.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Mr. Coleman, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Angela Behrens on behalf of the respondent, Secretary of State Steve Simon. The court should affirm because the appellant's arguments that this law should be changed are policy arguments best directed to the legislature, and they cannot meet their heavy burden of establishing that the statute is unconstitutional.
Well, can we go to this issue? And this is, and I think the appellant's brief was screaming for an answer to the question, what is the reason for the timing of the restoration of rights? And we've got to get to that, whether we're applying strict scrutiny or a rational basis.
Well, I want to back up one moment to the discussion that the panel had with Mr. Coleman. And it is significant that the source of the disenfranchisement is in our Constitution. And I recognize that this may make many people bristle when viewed from the modern lens, but there is a very long history of tying voting rights to conduct dating back to ancient Greece and Rome, and it has been a collateral consequence of a conviction. And I'm not aware when there's a state, only in a state constitutional challenge, of the need to justify the reason for the provision in the Constitution. As to the re-enfranchisement, here there is a basis. And I think this distinction between disenfranchisement and re-enfranchisement is important. It's not just semantics. Again, the Constitution is the source of the disenfranchisement. The statute re-enfranchises. And what we saw following the constitutional ratification was this patchwork process over time, and restoration of rights was never automatic until 1963, and it has never been before completion of sentence. And when the advisory committee in 1962 was looking at Chapter 609 as a whole, they decided it made sense to restore the right that was lost for the conviction when the criminal sanction for the conviction was ended, and that would further rehabilitation. The appellants focus on what the legislature did not do. That's not the legal standard. It is rational basis, and there's no doubt, I think, amongst the parties that rehabilitation can be furthered through re-enfranchisement. The legislature could have gone further, it still can, but the lack of doing so does not make what the legislature did in 1963 unconstitutional. And if we can return to that
in the history that you gave before the enactment of the statute that we're concerned with here, that you actually had to get a judge, even if you had been discharged from probation, you had still had to go to a judge to get a restoration of rights. There wasn't
an
automatic a restoration.
That's right, Your Honor. People both had to ask, and not only did they have to ask, the final decision maker still had discretion. So this focus on the lack of community supervision back in 1858 and the changes in the criminal justice system don't change the meaning of the Constitution. Because there was no community supervision in 1858, that meant completion of sentence was release from prison. But the framers did not use the language until released from prison. They used, as has been discussed, passive voice of unless restored to civil rights. Something else has to happen. And while there wasn't a lengthy debate by the delegates in enacting this provision at the Constitution, the discussion was significant because the delegates went through three different options. One delegate said, this whole provision seems very harsh, let's strike it. That didn't pass. Another delegate thought it wasn't harsh enough and wanted to make it permanent and eliminate any option for restoration. And then the third option is what stayed in, what was ratified by the voters of restored to civil rights. And the delegates understood what that would mean, either a pardon or legislative action. That the framers rejected permanent disenfranchisement through the Constitution is not the equivalent of a mandate to ever restore or to restore at a particular point. And certainly in the reply brief, the appellant said the secretary was arguing this isn't subject to judicial review. Of course it is. It is rational basis review though. And so there's still reasons to look at what the legislature did, but it's only in rational basis review because there is no fundamental right. The cases that the appellants rely on are all cases where people already had the right to vote. So the court was appropriately looking at whether these time, place, or manner restrictions that might burden that right was permissible. But here the question is whether the right even exists. And because it doesn't, the appellant's claims are subject only to rational basis review. And as we've discussed, what the legislature did was rational. It took a patchwork process that vested people with discretion, and they made voting rights easier.
Okay, how do you respond, though, to the appellant's arguments that this statute, the way it's applied, disproportionately disenfranchises minorities?
Certainly, and we're not minimizing the statistics that the appellants presented. This isn't a case where the court needs to discredit any statistics or the research, but the attributable causation of those statistics are processes within the criminal justice system. There has never been an argument that the re-enfranchisement process is disproportionately affecting people. The arguments all relate to what causes the felony conviction in the first place. but the statute only applies to those who have been convicted. And within that group, it is applied equally. Everyone is treated the same. Restoration comes at the same point. And that's why Russell and the heightened rational basis don't apply, because in Fletcher and Frazier and in Russell, the Supreme Court has been clear that the challenge statute has to be causing the disparate impact. Russell is a prime example. Within the criminal case, the defendant challenged the disparate impact, and he prevailed in that. But even if the court...
Can I go back to my original question? Because I'm just not sure you answered it. And that is, you know, what is the rational basis, though, for making it upon discharge as opposed to upon the immediate release from incarceration? Why would you do it that way instead of the other way when there may be some benefits to, you know, at least it's being argued that there's benefits to allowing a felon who has been released to have the immediate right to vote?
Well, of the history that's still available from that time, I think it was a matter of just a temporal duration for the collateral consequence from the advisory committee. It was upon completion of sentence. It just made sense to that. At that point, the legislature felt confident the person was fully participating member of society and to remove all consequences that had traveled with it to the person with the conviction. So that was the point. It was completion of sentence. The legislature certainly could have gone further, but for whatever reason, in 1963, the legislature viewed completion of sentence as the appropriate time because the criminal sentence was over at that point.
Ms. Behrens, in 1963, did Minnesota law provide for probation, parole, supervised release, or their like in a similar manner to the way it's provided for today?
I know they existed. I will confess, I don't know the exact details, but I think the concepts have always been the same in terms of probation and parole, where you're in the community and subject to revocation of release. They did exist. The advisory committee expressly recognized parole and probation and that people in the community then did not have the rights to vote. And the history from the 1970s is also relevant within the discussion, because in 1971, when the legislature established this constitutional commission, the entire point was to look at this document from 1858 and evaluate whether it still spoke for the people of Minnesota in light of political, social, and economic changes. And that commission heard testimony, again, urging the removal of the felony disenfranchisement provision, but that didn't go in the revised document. And certainly by the 70s, there was still probation, parole, and many of the changes that have been argued in the appellant's brief related to the criminal justice system. But again, it was left in our constitution and it was viewed as a legislative policy matter. And the Richardson versus Ramirez decision in 1974, the Supreme Court again commented, similar to here, there are many amici. There's clearly advocates for changing this law, but it's not the role of the court to choose when to restore rights when there's not a legal basis to do so.
To clarify, Ms. Behrens, you made reference to the 1962 Advisory Committee report, and you said they made references to parole and probation, et cetera. Did they make those references in connection with the proposed 609-165, or do you mean to say in other places in that large report?
No, it was specifically within the section about 609-165, both in the preface to the report on page 42 of the addendum and on page 43, the comment directly below the statute.
So that would indicate that the advisory committee was aware that that some people would be released before the expiration of the sentence, but that they would continue to remain disenfranchised under the proposed statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Ms. Behrens, can I ask you Well, first, perhaps a simple question. Do you believe there's any ambiguity in Article 7, Section 1 as it relates to the disenfranchisement language?
No.
Then secondly, do you believe that language obligates the legislature to identify a time period in which civil rights are restored?
No.
So if that's the case, the legislature tomorrow, not likely to happen, I suspect, could just eliminate subdivisions 1 and 2, at least the relevant subdivisions of this statute. And that would not be unconstitutional in your opinion?
Well, it would be subject to judicial review. We'd have to look at the reasons and if they were drawing different lines, if there was any intentional intent of discrimination, there could be a legal problem.
That's why I asked the other question first. If the Constitution does not obligate the legislature to identify any civil rights restoration, why would there need to be judicial review of the legislature exercising that discretion not to identify one, which I assume would leave us back to the pardon option, which in the early part of the Constitution was the only option?
Well, I think it goes back to the standard of review, because depending on what the legislature did, even if there's not a fundamental right involved, there would be rational basis review, there would be equal protection claims, or as we saw in Hunter v. Underwood, where the Alabama Constitution still violated the federal Constitution. So the legislature has very broad discretion, but it's not completely unfettered or unreviewable.
And how do we get past, and I think you identify this in your brief, the first step of equal protection analysis. What's the source of similarly situated people being treated differently, if at all, in your opinion?
Well, because the disenfranchisement only applies to those with a felony conviction, the relevant universe of people is those with a felony conviction. And the only classification that the statute draws is between completion of sentence and those who haven't completed their sentence. And as Judge Hooten highlighted earlier, there are all sorts of differences between people who have completed their sentence and who haven't completed their sentences. So I think that's a threshold reason the equal protection claim fails as well. But even if the court reaches the merits, it still fails rational basis.
Is that because your point being is there are no individuals similarly situated who are treated differently? All those with felons under that statute until they are discharged through probation do not have voting rights, so they're all treated equally.
Correct.
Thank you.
And unless the court has any further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm. The appellants have noted strong policy reasons that the legislature may want to reevaluate this issue. There are again bills before the legislature this session, but this is not a hearing before a committee of the legislature. They are instead asking the court to take the extraordinary step of striking down a statute. And because there is no right to vote before completion of sentence and the statute survives rational basis, the district court correctly entered summary judgment for the secretary. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before? All right, hearing no other questions, thank you. We will proceed with the appellant for rebuttal.
I need to be, there we go. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, so briefly on Article 7, and then I do want to revisit the Russell and heightened rational basis review, because frankly, we do not understand the secretary's position on it. And it's an attempt to rewrite the case law. But on Article 7, the secretary simply asserts that the framers would have understood that persons in the community following a felony conviction would not possess the right to vote unless some other branch of government took action. That's asserted. Where's the evidence for it? The secretary has not come forward with historical evidence to make that point.
Mr. Coleman, isn't the evidence the provision itself? How would one read that any other way without reading words into that article?
Your Honor, I would suggest that the secretary's interpretation is the one that reads words that into the article that are not there. The Article 7 does not say persons cannot vote unless restored to civil rights by the legislature. or upon getting a pardon from the governor. That is not there. What
is there is they cannot vote.
Unless restored to civil rights. And that right. If we look at the context and the historical evidence, which we established in the record through both Professor Carson and Professor Eugen, in ample terms, and the secretary even acknowledges that community supervision did not exist at the time. So if we faithfully try to understand what the framers intended based on the actual text they put in the Constitution, the chosen text, which should be our starting point, and the facts, the historical facts at the time, there is no basis to write in language that does not exist. So the easiest way to interpret Article 7, faithful with the text and the framers' intent and the historical evidence, is to read it to restore voting rights upon release from incarceration. At the time of founding, our criminal justice system was a simple system. Folks were either incarcerated or they weren't. And there was no mechanism to exercise control with regard to parole or voting rights or anything else when persons were no longer incarcerated. So we think that is the proper interpretation of the Constitution. It's one that establishes a bright line, easy to administer rule. And it's also faithfully adheres to this to the courts and the state's long recognition that we should not expand deprivation of the right to vote unnecessarily or for no good reason. Turning to...
the way you're interpreting it, you could almost, it's almost like you're rewriting the Constitution to say, unless you're released from incarceration, and that those words aren't there.
Your Honor, the text of the Constitution says that unless you're
saying a restoration of rights is synonymous with release from prison, whereas this state has decided that there should, that no one should have to serve the full term if they've been compliant with the rules of incarceration, and they serve 2/3, and they've decided that 1/3 of that is to be served in the community, that's part of their term. So they've actually, unlike other states, which just don't provide for all of this, that's one of the decisions the legislators made to basically ensure that people, once they're released from incarceration, are able to reintegrate into the community. So
supervised release is one component, but Your Honor, of the 53,000 Minnesotans who are disenfranchised, about 47,000 of them are persons on probation, mostly for drug crimes. And again, there's simply no reason to think that the framers intended that outcome. That system has expanded, deprived the voting rights wildly beyond anything that the framers could have originally intended. Your Honor,
I know both of us want to talk about Russell, I think. So maybe if you don't mind, I'll lead us there.
Please, Your Honor.
Ms. Behrens made reference to Fletcher's discussion about Russell. So Fletcher says that, basically, to paraphrase a little bit, the Russell test applies if there is a statutory classification demonstrably adversely affects one race differently than other races. And I guess I see a few problems there for you. One, I'm not sure that there is a statutory classification at all. Secondly, I'm not sure that it affects one race differently than any other race, at least, of all those people who come up for discharge of sentence, it operates in the same way, it seems. Also, I'm not sure if it adversely affects anyone, since it allows re-enfranchisement. So for those reasons, to me, I am making a statement more than a question, I understand, but it seems that the district court's reasoning that it's simply impossible to apply the Russell test, that makes some sense to me. So please go ahead and respond to my statement.
Yeah, so Russell, and you're right, Your Honor, Fletcher Properties makes clear that if a statute creates a racial disparity, then heightened rational basis review applies. This statute clearly does. So the statutory classification. I'm puzzled by Your Honor's suggestion that there is no statutory classification. Our clients, the reason we're here, and the thrust of all the questions in my original argument was that was going to our clients being classified as ineligible to vote, and the legislature having made a choice to classify them as ineligible to vote until discharge of sentence rather than incarceration. That's a legislative choice. It classifies them as deprived of voting rights until discharge of sentence. Now, as to whether
isn't it the Constitution which makes a classification? Everyone may vote subject to these other eligibility criteria, but felons may not vote unless restored to rights. But the statute is pretty it's open-ended. I mean, everybody who discharges their sentence, regardless of any classification, the only classification is whether they've discharged their sentence, I suppose.
Right, but I think everybody in our virtual courtroom, including the secretary, has acknowledged that at a minimum, the legislature has the discretion to restore voting rights upon discharge. So they've made a classification. The legislature came to this. They have a pool of people who have been convicted of a felony but live in the community, and they've made a legislative decision to refuse to restore voting rights until discharge. Not only that, but that decision is made with the racial disparities in our criminal justice system. So we have a pool of people who are arrested, convicted, serve time. We know that there's profound racial disparities in that group of population, in that population. And the statutory classification comes to that pool of people, recognizes it, that there are racial disparities, and chooses to disenfranchise them. So that is directly causing a disparate impact, disproportionately disenfranchising persons of color. That's the direct effect of the statute. We would reject the notion that the court should somehow look past that for any reason. Another way to get at that is Professor Ugin discusses the outright racist use of felony disenfranchisement post-Reconstruction by many states. Those statutes were racially neutral on their face. But Southern states, knowing that there were profound disparate impacts and racial disparities in their criminal justice systems, could leverage that into political inequality, into racial disenfranchisement. We do not, even though the legislature, the courts in Russell does not ask for discriminatory motive or benign intent, we think that the courts absolutely play a critical role here when we have persons of color who have been disproportionately denied voting rights, denied access to political participation. We're simply asking the court to say, why? Why do we do this? What's the purpose? And we would strongly urge the court to Mr. ask Coleman, that question. And to ask that question is to strike down this system.
Judge Hoot, may I ask one follow-up question? Even if we were to presume that Russell would apply, Mr. Coleman, notwithstanding, I think the questions Judge Johnson asked, didn't the Frazier Court give more explanation of the impact and the calculations that would have to occur? And if I understand the record here, there was no calculations of the participation rate of the crimes by race, and that would have to occur just like in that case, the participation in the gang activity as it applied to that law. And only if that was to occur, and then if you would have a disparate impact, in other words, if based on the percentage of blacks or whites or other minority groups that committed crimes, if their voting rights were somehow affected at a different rate than other felons, then that would be a disparate impact. But I thought that's what the judge had made a point to, and you discredited that based on Russell, but it looked like that was the correct analysis pursuant to the Frazier calculation. And I didn't see that in the record. In fact, I thought I saw in one of the reports that just a small mention of participation rates, but real no analysis of that. And that would have to occur to complete the package of racial impact. Am I correct in that regard?
I'm not sure I entirely follow the thread, but let me just address just to clarify, Frazier.
Just so I understand, my main point is that I saw a lot of statistics on percentage of population, but correct. not the percentage of participation in the crimes. That's a whole different set of analysis that would have to be added to percentage of population. And I would assume by Frazier is more important than the percentage of the population taking part in crimes.
No, Your Honor, the problem with Frazier was the gang affiliation statute, and the defendant appellant in that circumstance was trying to make the comparison between persons arrested and subject to the gang enhancement, persons of color. And then the question was, well, to what extent are whites affiliated with gangs such that we can suss out a disparate impact between those two groups of people? And there was infirmities in the evidence. That's not what's the issue here. Here, it is quite clearly established that of all persons living in the community, potentially eligible to vote, persons of color are disenfranchised at higher numbers. And I guess I would urge Your Honor, I mean, this has never been disputed in the record that there is a disproportionate impact. And so I don't think there's been any, I don't think there are grounds to contest the disproportionate impact, disparate impact that we've established. So fewer than white, 1% of white persons living in the community are disenfranchised. 4 to 5% of African Americans living in the community are disenfranchised. 9% of American Indians living in the community are disenfranchised. That's a disparate impact, and that triggers a heightened rational basis review.
Isn't the issue is whether it's the effect of this restoration of rights statute? I mean, the reason for the disproportionate impact would be because there's more, as you pointed out in your briefing, there's more arrests and more convictions against people of color than whites, at least on a percentage basis. And if that problem is resolved, wouldn't that take care of the restoration of rights issue? And to the extent that the legislature's already addressed that problem with regard to the reform of the drug laws, as well as the periods of probation, our discussion now is dependent upon that, isn't it? Rather than saying that the legislature, by passing this relatively neutral statute, it is a neutral statute, weren't applying that it disproportionate, that the statute itself disproportionately affects people of color. You understand my question? In other words, it's happening. I think the respondent indicated it's at the front end that the numbers are different. It's not by virtue of the statute.
That's an interpretation of Russell that I don't think is grounded anywhere in the case law, Your Honor. In Russell, the statutory classification was powder versus crack cocaine. That's neutral on its face. It doesn't refer to any race. We don't have any evidence of benign, of discriminatory intent. That wasn't the question. We don't know why more persons of color were arrested for crack cocaine. Was that a matter of enforcement? Was it urban versus rural? We have no idea. The court simply looked at the disparate impact. What happened? What are the numbers when we compare who is affected by the statute? And we look at the data. After the fact, after the statute, to see the real world impact. And if there's a disparate impact, then we don't necessarily strike the statute down. We apply heightened rational basis review. We recognize a disparate impact, and we simply ask, what's the purpose? Why did the legislature do this? And here we don't have one. So again, I think this, the statutory classification here is much more direct than the powder versus crack cocaine or gang affiliations or whatever, because it doesn't, the scheme itself takes the population that's living in the community, that is a pool of people. We know the racial composition of that people, and it disenfranchises all of them with the disparate impact. That's direct. There are no intervening causes between the statutory classification and the disproportionate impact, which in this case is structured political inequality. And again, we think the court needs to involve itself in asking if we have a system, a scheme where the legislature didn't have to, but made a choice to adopt a classification that results in unequal racial political inequality, let's figure out why. Why do we do this? There's no purpose for it.
Any other questions? All right, very good.
I have one
short,
simple question. Mr. Coleman, do you concede that the claims of two of your four original clients are now moot because they've been discharged?
Thanks for raising that, Your Honor. I do think that's worth addressing. No, we don't concede that. We certainly don't think it's properly before the court. And in fact, we would say the mootness argument itself is moot, or at least raises the type of judicial stability concerns underlying mootness. That is, we have two plaintiffs that raise their claims. The court's going to have to work through all of the reasons why or why not they're entitled to relief. Whether Mr. Josephicus Varner or Mr. Caldwell, whether their claims, whether they need to be restored to voting rights, all of those issues are relevant to the issues that the court has to decide. And in fact,
are you urging us to rely on an exception to the mootness doctrine? I correct, both of those people now have the right to vote.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
So you're asking us for their sake. I think you're relying on an exception to the mootness doctrine. Have you already briefed this? Is this in our? I didn't see it in your blue brief. But did you file a memorandum with a motion? Forgive me for not remembering. I lost track of that small part of the case. But
yeah, Your Honor, the district court did not reach it, and we think they properly didn't reach it. We did not. This hasn't been briefed, and the evidence on the exceptions to mootness are not in the record and have not been developed. And we think that's an additional reason to follow the district court and not reach mootness. So we certainly know with 53,000 Minnesotans disenfranchised that the problem is capable of repetition. We think, you know, the record should be developed if the court wanted to get there, felt a need to get there about it evading review. We don't think that this issue has been, we don't think it presents a live issue that's where we have a record that's
review. We do often consider if circumstances change during the life of appeal, we do often consider that. There was a recent letter about Mr. Varner, and I think Mr. and Ms. Caldwell perhaps was discharged at an earlier time. Do those people's claims present any different issues that are not reflected by the two remaining plaintiffs?
No, like I say, Your Honor, the remaining plaintiffs present all of the issues, and I think, you know, sort of forced the court to have to work through all of the same issues in our briefing, such that Mr. Caldwell and Mr. Josephicus Varner's circumstances are relevant to those issues. What I will say is that the factual circumstances underlying Mr. Varner's and Mr. Caldwell's disenfranchisement are properly before the court and should be considered. And Mr. Josephicus Varner's affidavit is particularly compelling. He was convicted of drug use, never spent any time in jail, but was disenfranchised for 20 years. We actually don't know why he was re-enfranchised or how that happened, which raises its own concerns about the arbitrariness of the scheme. Voting rights, you know, we think should not be haphazardly restored.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you both for the excellent briefing and the excellent oral arguments this morning. And I also want to thank all the the participants in the amici briefing, which was extensive, as probably as extensive as anything I've seen since I've been on the court of appeals. So thanks to all of you for your input here. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.